Hey fam, thanks for listening to the Better Man Podcast. This season, the podcast is brought to you by Aroga Drive, one of my favorite energy supplements. If you're looking for all-day clean energy that won't let you crash and burn, Drive is the one. Stop pounding the coffee, stop crushing the Red Bulls. Instead, take Aroga Drive one time in the morning and you're good for the rest of the day. Check it out in the show notes or visit arogadrive.com.
Professor Piercy, so excited to be with you here on the campus of Houston Christian University in this beautiful chapel. What a wonderful building this is. And it's, I know on behalf of the Better Man family, the Better Man Network, a lot of evangelical men and Christian men who tune in that are wanting to be more like King Jesus. They're wanting to really walk in God's good design for their life. This is going to be super beneficial for them. So thank you so much for agreeing to meet with us today.
Well, thanks for having me. It really is an honor.
Excellent. Excellent. I love in your phenomenal book. I'm a big fan. It was actually recommended to me by a mentor of mine. And he said, you have to read this, The Toxic War on Masculinity. You talk about that secular script around masculinity and manhood today. Could you unpack that a little bit, and so our hearers and our viewers can really get a glimpse of what is the world saying about men today?
Well, what I found interesting is this is one of my most fact-based books, and so I will start by answering with a sociological study because it revealed that men are actually trapped in a sense between two competing scripts for masculinity. And that's what we need to understand. So this is a sociologist named Michael Kimmel, and he's not a Christian, but he gets invited to speak all around the world. And so he came up with a clever experiment. He said, I began asking young men two questions. First, what does it mean to be a good man? Right. If you're at a funeral and in the eulogy, somebody says he was a good man, what does that mean? And the sociologist said all around the world, young men had no trouble answering that. They would immediately start listing things like honor, duty, sacrifice, integrity, do the right thing, look out for the little guy. I like that one. And then be a protector, be a provider, be responsible. And so he would ask them, where'd you learn that? Huh. And they'd say, I don't know. It's just in the air we breathe. Or you and I would say, because men are made in God's image.
Right.
It is universal. They do have an innate, inherent sense of what it means to be a good man.
Wow.
God did not give them their unique strengths to get whatever they want.
That's right.
But to love, to serve, to provide, to protect. And by the way, if they were in a country, these young men, with a Christian background, then they would often say, it's part of our Judeo-Christian heritage.
Oh, wow.
But then he would ask the follow-up question, right? The second question was, what if I say to you, man up, be a real man? And the young men themselves would say, oh, no, that's completely different. That means be strong, be tough, never show weakness, suck it up, play through pain, make it at all costs, be competitive, get rich, get laid, using their language.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so this sociologist concluded that all around the world, men are trapped between competing scripts. On the one hand, they do have that innate knowledge because they're made in God's image of what it means to be a good man. Or we might appeal to Romans 2, right? That we all have a conscience.
Wow.
And even in non-Christian cultures, they That's have right. a sense of manly honor, manly duty. But they are then also pressured, especially in our modern culture, to live out very different traits.
Yeah.
Not that all those traits are bad. I mean, being tough is a good thing in a crisis.
Sure.
But if it gets decoupled from the vision of the good man, the moral standard, then it can slide into entitlement, dominance, misogyny, and so on. In other words, it can become the Andrew Tate the standard of fast cars, fast money, fast women.
That's right.
By the way, what's not in the book is I recently got an email from a former graduate student here at Houston Christian University. And she said, she's now teaching at a Christian university. I teach at a Christian
University. No worries.
My graduate student is now teaching at a high school.
Okay.
And she said, all my male students are fans of Andrew Tate.
Yeah.
They're even using Andrew Tate quotations in their yearbook.
Yeah.
I said, where do you teach? At a classical Christian school.
Wow.
So that was my response to, wow, if we are not communicating a Christian standard, a Christian vision,
yes,
an aspiring vision of Christian manhood, then our young men are reaching out to these online influencers. I don't know about, they may not know this, but I heard an interview with Andrew Tate where he said quite openly that he's a pimp.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm a pimp. And what I do is I produce pornography.
That's right.
And there's a new influencer who's coming up and is becoming very popular. His name is Myron Gaines.
Hmm.
And he's been heralded by the New York Post as the new Andrew Tate.
Wow.
His program is called Fresh and Fit. And his tagline is, I help men transform from simps into pimps.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And he's written a book. He's even written a book in which he says, all the relationships between men and women has always been transactional. All men are Johns. All women are whores.
Wow.
And his program is becoming quite popular.
That's it.
So this is the secular, you ask, your opening question is, what's the secular script?
Yeah.
I think that's the secular script that a lot of young men are picking up today.
It is. And that goes back to one of your previous works. As a matter of fact, you and I were talking about it earlier, The Total Truth. That when we don't approach things with a biblical worldview, with a biblical framework, we'll allow philosophical kind of worldviews to seep in, and eventually those will dominate and take over, right? So many young men today that don't know how to approach their manhood, they don't know how to approach their strength, they don't know how to approach their masculinity, and with and in a biblical framework, they'll listen to Andrew Tate and David Goggins and from simps to pimps. I mean, that becomes their mantra. These become the loudest voices in the room.
Yeah, I like the way you put it. You know, if there's a vacuum, something will rush in to fill it. So if there's a vacuum in the church, if we don't have good men's programs and inspiring men with a biblical view of masculinity, then we shouldn't be surprised that secular views come on in. I was interviewed by a young Christian couple for a podcast. They were newly married and they had a podcast. So I turned it around and asked them some questions. And I said, what's your experience in the church? Do you think even in the church, young men are picking up these secular scripts? And they said, absolutely. They said, very much, like in the dating scene, even in the church, it's assumed that men are just more naturally prone to sin and vice and lust, you know, and that the sexual temptation is just roiling under the surface.
Wow.
And you're ready to break through at any moment. That it's up to the woman to make sure, you know, that she keeps her boundaries, that she's the one who's in charge, you know, that she's tasked, you know, with being sort of the spiritual leader almost. But the young couple told me that in the Christian church, there is a double standard where in a sense, men are given, the sort of let off the hook.
Wow.
Because, it's just the masculine nature.
Yeah.
And then women are, in a sense, tasked with being the moral guardians of the home, which, by the way, goes all the way back to the 19th century. But if this young couple is any indication, it's still very much part of the church.
Absolutely. And that's interesting. It's one of my favorite parts about your book is the historical perspective, because the vacuum didn't happen overnight. And it goes back to, like you said, the 19th century, the 18th century. You talked about the Industrial Revolution and things of that nature. So kind of, if you would, paint for us a picture of what has happened historically with these scripts and with manhood.
Yeah, let me lead into it by saying that I have discovered a lot of people don't really understand that my book is a book of apologetics. You know, everything I write is apologetics. It's all about how do we discern what's wrong with the secular world?
Wow.
You know, because people are trying to drag it into, you know, in-house debates over egalitarian and complementarian. And actually, I don't deal with that. And by the way, parenthetically, and I also explain why I don't deal with that, because two of the top marriage researchers who I researched say it doesn't seem to make much difference. Brad Wilcox is a sociologist at the University of Virginia, considered one of the top marriage researchers in the country. And he said, we just don't find much difference, you know, if a man has an egalitarian gender theory or if he has a complementarian gender theory. They look at the whys, right? Because the assumption is that these marriages are oppressive and you know, they're domineering patriarchs.
That's right.
And so they ask the wives, and the wives of complementarian men report the highest level of happiness.
Yeah.
And the wives of egalitarian men do not report higher levels. You and I might expect that they would, but they did the studies, and they said egalitarian marriages are not any happier.
Wow.
And so, do you know what does make a difference? Whether the man puts his family first.
That's right.
Does he think the family is the most important part of his life?
Hmm.
Men who have family-centric values.
Come on.
Treat their wives and children well.
That's so true.
And then the other expert that I cite is not a Christian. His name is John Gottman, but he's considered the top marriage psychologist in the country. And he said, the couples who come into my practice, some of them believe the man should be in charge of the marriage, and some come in with much more egalitarian views. And he says, we don't see a difference.
Hmm.
And here's how he concluded. He said, emotionally intelligent husbands have figured out the most important thing, which is how to convey honor and respect to your wife.
Wow.
And so I quote those two experts and I say, therefore, I'm not dealing with these in-house debates among Christians. My interest is answering the charges from the secular world. Like, why does the secular world get their concept of masculinity so wrong?
Yeah.
So wrong that they actually think it's toxic. And so to answer that question, you have to go back to when did negative language about men start?
Huh.
Well, it actually started, like you said, with the Industrial Revolution. Because before that time, men worked alongside their wives and children all day on the family farm, the family industry, the family business. And so the cultural expectation on men focused much more on their caretaking role, their responsibility for the common good of the household. In fact, here's a fascinating historical fact. At that time, most literature to parents, in books and articles, sermons, to parents was addressed to fathers.
Wow.
Now, if you go into a typical store today, right, the books are all written to mothers.
Yeah, and a lot of sermons are preached towards women and mothers today. That's right. Yeah.
Yes, but fathers were considered the primary parent. And so all the literature addressed the father.
Wow.
And of course, fathers actually did spend as much time with their children as mothers did, which is hard for us to imagine today. But their sons especially were basically apprentices working alongside their fathers in their father's craft or business on the farm.
Yeah.
So the question, and I like reading even non-Christian historians because they will say things like, the definition, this is a direct quote from a secular historian. He says, the definition of masculine virtue was duty to God and man.
Wow.
So then you say, whoa, where did we lose that?
Yes.
The Industrial Revolution took work out of the home. And of course, men had to follow their work out of the home into factories and offices. And for the first time in American history, men were not working alongside their wives and children, people they loved, people that they had a moral bond with. Instead, they were working as individuals in competition with other men.
Mm.
And you can imagine that the mentality does start to shift. And that's when you see the literature also start to change. People began to protest that men were losing the caretaking ethos that they had had in the colonial era, that they were becoming competitive, egocentric, self-interested, greedy, acquisitive, look out for number one. I'm using the language of the day.
Yeah.
In fact, many people began to complain. This struck me as interesting that they actually said men are starting to treat their career as their idol.
Wow.
Career success, financial achievement began to be treated as an idol. And it's interesting how many critics used that phrase.
Yeah.
So if you want to go back to where the negative language started, it's when men were disconnected from their families. We're so used to it today, we don't realize how shocking it was at the time. And so, again, if you go back to the literature of the day, there's an incredible amount of books and articles and sermons decrying the the fact that the family's been gutted. You know, the head of the home is not there anymore all day.
Right.
That, you know, it's been, the family's been hollowed out. Hmm. A magazine called Parents Magazine, 1842, had an article in which it said, the greatest cause of domestic sorrow in our day is paternal neglect.
Wow.
And it went on to say, the father is toiling at his business early and late and has no time to fulfill his duties to his children.
What?
So that's the kind of language that we use. Another article said, excuse me, this was a book at the time, said, the mainstay of the family, the head of the home, is hardly here from weekend to weekend.
Yes.
And another was Frances Willard. She was the president of the Women's Christian Temperance Movement, Union, it was called, Women's Christian Temperance Union. She was, some historians say, the most influential woman of the 19th century.
Wow.
And she wrote, the father is meant to be the prototype of the divine in the home, because God is our father.
That's right.
And yet the prototype of the divine is not there from Sunday to Sunday.
Wow.
So it's good to remind ourselves that this actually was quite, it was quite traumatic at the time.
Absolutely.
In fact, many of the laws and policies that we think back to that got started back then, like reducing the workday, it was 12 hours, right? But reduced to 12 hours and then to 10, then to finally to 8. It was driven by people saying fathers need more time with their families.
Wow.
That's the main reason it was driven. Or even something like blue laws. We think that was religiously motivated, right?
Yep.
Close the shops on Sunday. No, it was people like Frances Willard, her organization fought for the blue laws so that fathers could have at least one day with their family.
Wow.
So a lot of those laws and policies were the family wage is another one. How can we pay men enough so that they can support their family without working such long hours away from their wife and kids?
Yeah.
So all that to say, the history really helps us to get perspective on when did this happen? When did people start treating fatherhood? When did the language change and become negative towards in the characterization of the male character?
Yeah. You had mentioned the father as the reflection of the divine. You know, the Puritans called that the Moonish triplex, that Christ was the chief priest, prophet, and king, and then dad is the lowercase chief prophet and king of his home. He reflects that to his home. The Puritans, who kind of coined that phrase, you know, dad as prophet, priest of his home, they wouldn't even let you join the church if you weren't leading and discipling and providing and loving and shepherding your family well. And today it seems we've gotten just so far away from that, that this idea of the fatherly importance and the fatherly role, not just as a provider of financial means, but security, emotional support, physical support, psychological support, spiritual support is huge. I think the statistic is in 1960, 4% of children grew up in a fatherless home. And today, I think it's close to 40%.
It's 40%.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
40%. Yeah, it's the highest rate of single parenthood in the world.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing? America is at the top of something like that. We're at the top of the rate of single parenthood in the world.
Mm.
So it is, and everyone knows that fatherless kids grow up at risk of more social pathologies, right? That they're more likely to have trouble at school, to drop out of school, to be addicted to drugs and alcohol, to have kids outside of marriage, to commit crime. Hmm. I used to work for Prison Fellowship, which is an international prison ministry. Oh, so yeah. We knew this firsthand.
Wow.
That the majority of young people who end up behind bars are fatherless boys, and especially a violent crime. Hmm. Violent criminals are almost all growing up in fatherless homes.
Yeah.
And what you mentioned earlier, unemployment, male unemployment has also gone way up in terms of, it's not showing up in the unemployment statistics because they stopped looking for work.
Mm-hmm.
And so researchers had to dig deeper And now they have found that male unemployment is at Great Depression era levels.
Wow.
I was shocked because we all remember what a crisis that was.
Absolutely.
But now male unemployment is at Great Depression era levels.
Yeah.
So boys growing up in fatherless homes, the ripples go on for all the way into adulthood. You know, fatherless boys do not function as well.
Yep. And that doesn't even include young men like me who grew up with a father present, but was emotionally, physically, spiritually, psychologically detached. I mean, I remember most of my childhood, if my dad wasn't at work, he spent the majority of time in the garage.
Yes.
and might as well have not been there. So I call that the functional orphan, right? That wasn't actually orphan, but functionally lives as an orphan, from detached parents. And I just wonder how many men suffer from that today and the effects of that.
You know what? Just as a historical point, that word was used in the 19th century. The leading psychologist of the 19th century.
Wow.
When fathers were removed from the home because of the Industrial Revolution, he said, first of all, boys were growing up without their father's supervision, so they were rowdy and wild and undisciplined. And he wrote, and he said, never before has the American boy been so wild and so half-orphaned.
Wow.
That was his word, half-orphaned, because his father's out of the home and they're being raised by women in home, church, school. So the leading psychologist of the 19th century used that same word. He's a half orphan, because the father's not in the home anymore. I wanted to connect with you with my experience. I put it in the front of the book because I grew up in a very abusive home. Hmm. And by the way, the same thing though. My dad was a tinkerer, so even when he was home, he was always doing home improvement projects.
Wow.
So we just never interacted except when he was angry and then he beat us.
Oh, right. Goodness.
You know, he would not say, "Do this, I'll spank you." He'd say, "Do this, I'll beat you."
Wow.
And then he would carry through on his threats. Mm. So I put it right at the front of the book, in a way to help.
Which,
people,
by the way, was very courageous. I just want to commend you on that. It was very courageous.
It's you're so very vulnerable.
Yes, you have to. Yeah.
But I did want people to know, I'll put it in the words of one psychologist who interviewed me said, "At least we know you're not writing from an ivory tower."
Wow.
We know that you're writing from the trenches. Yeah. And that's kind of the reason I put it there. I wanted people to realize I didn't grow up in a warm, loving, secure home. Mm. And I can, you know, so this is easy for me to say that men are good, that, you know, that Christian men are good. This was hard won. This is something that took a long time. As you can imagine, when I grew up, I became a very strong feminist, right? I read all the groundbreaking feminist books like Betty Friedan and Simone de Beauvoir, Kate Millett, Susan Brown Miller, all the foundational books for the feminist movement. And I thought they were wonderful. And then eventually I became a Christian, and that's when I started having to rethink this whole question.
Wow.
And so it's been, in a sense, at the end of the introduction of the book, I say, in a sense, I've been writing this book my whole life.
Yeah. And you do it with such, you and I had chatted before the interview, that a lot of sensationalists today, they want to come at you with a lot of charisma. I think you use the word pizzazz, but you write with such clarity. It shadows a deep understanding of what you're talking about and what you're writing about. And I love how you elevate clarity above the charisma, because men need clarity today. I think churches need clarity today around what is true and what is good and what is right, because of that secular script that really has infiltrated every aspect of life, including the church.
Yeah, and we also talked about why my book does not have a really polemical tone to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the most fact-based book I've written. You know, it's really based on studies and data. And the most surprising of those facts is that evangelical men who attend church regularly, who are really committed, test out as the most loving and engaged husbands and fathers. And the reason, I mean, I was as surprised as anyone to read this, because the assumption is, what we get from the media is, that Christian men are exhibit A of toxic masculinity.
That's right.
It was easy to find quotes, but I'll give you just one. This was the co-founder of the Church Two movement, which followed the Me Too movement.
Right.
And she said, the theology of male headship feeds the rape culture that we see permeating American Christianity today. And so the thing is that Christian psychologists and sociologists were listening to this and saying, well, where's your evidence? You know, you're making these accusations, but where's your data?
Right.
So they went out and did the studies. And in my book, I quote some dozen or so studies that all found that the media stereotypes are dead wrong.
Right.
And that the Christian men, they do interview the wives as well. So their wives test out as saying they're the happiest with their husband's expressions of love and affection.
Yeah.
Christian men, evangelical men, test out as spending the most time with their children, 3.5 hours more per week than secular men.
Wow.
They have the lowest rate of divorce, 35% lower than secular couples. And actually, they have the lowest rate of domestic abuse and violence of any major group in America.
Yes.
So this was shocking. I did not expect this. I was blown away by these statistics. That's when I decided to write the book, by the way.
Right.
Is when I read these statistics, these studies, I said, I've got to get this information out. Churches don't know this.
That's
like,
right.
They don't know that Christian men are doing so well. Let me give you a quote, because that sometimes can crystallize it.
Hmm.
So Brad Wilcox at the University of Virginia, to give you a sense of his stature, he writes for places like the New York Times. So this is a direct quote. He said, it turns out that the happiest of all wives in America are religious conservatives.
Wow.
And they're focusing on the wives, because the assumption is that these marriages are oppressive to the wives.
Yeah, well, secular media hated that. They had to have hated that.
And it was in the New York Times, right in front of them. The happiest of all wives in America are religious conservatives. Fully 73% of women who hold conservative gender values and attend church regularly with their husbands have high quality marriages. And then, and actually, this is my favorite part of the quote. Then he turns to his secular colleagues and says, academics need to cast aside their prejudices against religious conservatives and evangelicals in particular. Evangelical Protestant married men with children are consistently the most engaged and loving husbands and fathers. Direct quote.
Yeah.
So that's what the data is showing. This is not a pep talk from some religious leader. You know, this is solid empirical evidence, and we should be bold about bringing it into the public square, as well as bringing it into our churches to empower men in our churches. One of my graduate students was a head of a very large Baptist church here in Houston. And she said, on Mother's Day, we honor the women and hand out roses. On Father's Day, we scold the men and tell them to do better.
Right.
So my book is Stop the Scolding.
Yes.
You know, that's my message. No more scolding. How about encouraging and supporting?
Yes. Yeah.
Men to, that actually you're doing very well.
Yeah. We're not going to shame and guilt men into God's design. We're not going to shame and guilt men back into the church. You know, one of the things I love about Better Man is we often say, we're not winning men back to the church. We're trying to win the church back to men.
Oh,
and
yes.
I was recently with a very prominent church leader in San Antonio. And he asked me, he said, Chris, what's one thing we could do today to help recapture some of the loyalty towards men? And I told him the very same thing, Miss Nancy. I said, no more dad jokes, no more embarrassing men, no more shaming men. I said, how about we start when we see a man leading his family or bringing his family to church or doing what God has called him to do? How about we just pull him aside and say, you know what? Well done. You know, great job. I see you. I want to encourage you because so much of that secular script, like you say, you know, headship and authority and hierarchy isn't toxic. It's part of a design. It's only toxic when it becomes manipulated, right? I think it was Dallas Willard who said, God's chief aim is to look upon the earth and find men he can entrust with his power, because we're so privy to abuse the power, to neglect the power, and then it goes wheels off. But I just love your voice in that, hey, listen, the evidence is showing, you know, and I want our men to hear this. You said committed evangelicals. We're not talking about cultural Christians or nominal Christians, which we get a lot here in the South.
Thank you for tuning in to the Better Man Podcast with Dr. Chris Harper and Professor Nancy Piercy. We'll continue the conversation next week with part two of The Toxic War on Masculinity with Chris and Professor Nancy Piercy. For more information about Professor Piercy, head over to her website, nancypiercy.com.
Hey, brothers, if we want to finish strong, we need to start strong. And I can't think of a better way to start your day than with some encouragement from God's Word. That's what Better Mornings, the Better Man Daily Devotional, is all about. Start your morning with Better Mornings and be the man God has called you to be. Check out the link in the show notes or visit betterman.com/resources and sign up for Better Mornings, the Better Man Daily Devotional.